first time we've actually had four people from four different time zones.
I believe it is. I believe that here on our latest episode of Mentioned in Dispatches, we are yet again pulling off a first. Bob, this is the first appearance for you on Mentioned in Dispatches, so welcome, Bob.
And, thank you.
Vance is normally coming to us from north of the wall, but this time he's all the way across the pond and actually further away than Bob is. So, Vance, hi from Italy.
Well, Vance is actually closer to me now than he normally is, and I'm not sure if I'm terribly comfortable about that.
I wouldn't be.
I'm about to get closer next week, Bob, so look at it.
Yeah, you're going to be even closer, aren't you? Oh, hell.
But I think Vance is further away than we've ever had somebody dial in for one of these, in large part because we haven't dialed anybody in from Asia before. So, Vance, where are you right now? You're in Naples?
I'm in Naples, yeah.
All right.
Very nice. Yeah.
5 o'clock on a very rainy afternoon.
Yeah. And then Jim's just back home. He's usually gallivanting around the world and writing about it for us. But welcome, Cyrano. Howdy, sir.
Hey, happy Sunday morning here in the chilly Midwest.
Yeah. Hey, we're in the chilly Southeast down here, and it's still kind of crazy. So as listeners can tell by my voice, I am not up to full speed on this podcast at the moment. So I'm going to throw out a question or two and let these three guys babble about it. An interesting conversation we were having right before the call started was about some of the different museums out there. Vance stumbled across a pretty cool one in Naples, and then Jim decided to tell us how his family's been escorted out of several for overstaying their welcome. It's not like Bob doesn't have 50 museums within a stone's throw of where he lives, including most of Hadrian's Wall. So, Jim, let's start with you telling us about getting escorted out of a couple of museums in different countries this past summer, and we'll let guys sort of jump in where they want to go.
Well, mainly by laughing at you, of course.
Well, right, that's what I'd expect. No, it's become something of an insider family joke for us in that I take my family on these trips. They're typically about Napoleonic battlefields, which means wandering around farmers' fields, I wrote down something that happened to me the last time I was over. I actually filmed a house at Teugen, from the Teugenhausen battlefield. And I posted that video in association with the article I wrote for the Armchair Dragoons, and I got a post to my YouTube feed from a guy saying, "Why are you filming my house?" And then he went on a little bit later, and he said, "Why are you standing in my field?" And I hope he was okay. I tried to say, "Look, we stayed on the paths and all this," but you know, Germans are an interesting lot. So usually we go out to the farm fields and we hang out there. But my wife loves museums. My son loves museums. He always has. And so we like to go to museums. And really, any kind of museum probably has something we'd like to see. Well, the problem with that is I sometimes think they pace the modern museum to be able to see it in, say, an afternoon or morning. Well, that's just not going to work for us. And as a result, 4 years ago, when we went to the British Museum, we were escorted out of the Elgin Marbles because they were closing. And I was actually engaged in conversation with one of the docents about how many times a week he gets somebody Greek to come to yell at him.
Oh, yes. We want our bits back.
Exactly. Yeah, the bits that were found on the ground, guys. Stop it. And which probably wouldn't exist if we hadn't collected them. But anyway...
No.
So it's to the point that if you go to the British Museum and you go right around the corner from where the marbles are themselves displayed, they actually have the writ that Lord Elgin received from the government to say, look, they said we could have them.
Honest.
Honest, yeah.
Look, so, I've got a note here from me mom saying we could have them.
Yeah, exactly. And so we got kicked out of there. And look, they're, you know, and I, if you've ever been at a museum at closing time, but when I was a grad student, I actually was a docent at the Milwaukee Art Museum. And what they do is they form a phalanx, and they go room to room, and they shove you in front of them, picking up guards as they go. You know, so as they go to another room, they say, all right, you're relieved. Everybody gone from your area. And you are following this. It's like Indiana Jones and that stupid rock. And so we got kicked out of the British Museum. We got kicked out of the National Portrait Gallery. Then when we were in Berlin, we got kicked out of the Deutsches Historisches Museum. Same reason. And on this trip, it was actually one of the worst. We went to the World War I Museum at Ingolstadt.
Oh, yeah.
Which is amazing. I didn't know about it. To go to your point, Brent, we were unaware of that it was there. I was in Ingolstadt to see the Bavarian Military Museum, which is right across the street, and which was very cool. It's got a lot of, you know, stuff from the Napoleonic period, some of the famous portraits of some of those battles of the 1809 campaign, as well as a bunch of stuff of the Archduke Charles. But along with the ticket, they said, do you want a ticket to our World War I museum? And I said, well, shoot, of course I do. Don't ask dumb questions. And it's wonderful. It is really well done. It's in an old castle. It's done in a horseshoe shape, but it is gigantic. And we knew we were in trouble because probably 30 minutes into the visit, the docents, every time, and I will, look, if you put a video up, I'm going to watch it. That's what it's for. It's
how dare you? Clearly there's something wrong with you.
Right. And so I, you know, and they put chairs there. So I'm going to sit and watch your video. This Frau, oh my God. When we sat down and started watching this video, she literally, not metaphorically, looked at her watch.
Marvelous.
As if to tap it and go, what are you doing? You cannot stay this long. You must go.
For you, the video is over.
Yeah. So we got shoved out of that one, too. So it's a remarkable thing that you have the... And I get it. Because we were at the Bavarian Military Museum for so long, we had less time available. But yeah, we... In fact, though, it was funny, because we bumped into a couple of fellows from Brighton.
Oh, yeah.
Who were visiting that museum. And we were looking at each other because, well, we were English speakers and we felt we could get away with it, as if to say, what is this woman doing? But by the time we were done and we got to this really interesting piece at the end, there's a really cool part at the end of the museum where they discuss very openly, and I think in a very, you know, for many, many years, any display of Nazism, whether it be a swastika or images of Hitler, were pretty taboo.
Yes.
Well, this was a really interesting display of, look, let's talk about how we went from World War I to World War II. And a lot of stuff I'd never seen before. A lot of really interesting street art, pamphlets, you know, the posters. A lot of that I'd never seen, and I wanted to take pictures, and I wanted to read this description. They were having none of it.
Really?
And we got straight thrown into the street, and I'll sort this out at the Last Judgment, but when we hit the door, it was 10 minutes to closing.
Oh, really?
And I went, you have thieved 10 minutes from me. So, no, I absolutely, and I've, you know, so I've been...
It's a good excuse to go back, though, Jim.
It is, and I would love to go back to Ingolstadt. The problem is I've got to get back to so many other places too, and yeah. there's other Napoleonic battlefields I've not even visited once. I absolutely love those museum spaces, and I guess I sort of love and hate when I find one that I hadn't expected. You love it because it's a wonderful surprise.
Yeah.
But you hate it because you probably haven't built your time into your schedule.
Yeah, true. Mind you, I mean, the videos and the reports you did kept us endlessly entertained because you probably managed to go to places that a lot of us would like to go, but we'll never be able to get there. So I used to follow them with, you know, really great interest. because you were sort of going to these places by proxy for me, you know.
Thanks
you could have you could have taken Doug with you.
We keep threatening to do that.
Well, the reason I say that
you,
is because
you live close enough to drive.
He's not
to drive though, Bob.
Yeah, the thing is, Doug's not the sort of bloke you can throw out of anywhere easily, is he? You know.
He would have given them such a look.
So, but no, they have. They've been really good. The visits and the videos, the pictures that you post have been very, very, very entertaining.
As we are recording this, Jim has sent me egg mule that I have in hand and need to get loaded to post. By the time this podcast is released, that post should probably be up and ready our audience to read.
Excellent. I mean, fans could send us some pictures from where he is, but I'm sure it'd be boring as hell watching all these engineers plotting on blowing up the universe. We don't really...
only the engineers I was dealing with.
No offense, fans.
5 days of physicists.
I think we did that amiss.
Physicists, you say?
Physicists.
So it's all abstract papers?
There's this week there was probably 90 people in every seminar, and there would have been 3 engineers.
When did you go home, Vance?
Eh?
So how long are you there for?
It's been all week, so I got here Sunday. I leave tomorrow.
Oh, lovely.
It was good. It was work, but most of it was interesting. Some of it was entertaining. Some of it I started a fist fight, so that was good too.
You managed to get some sightseeing in anyway.
Yes, yeah, we did. We got to see. We got to go see Pompeii on Friday. Spent 3 hours stomping around there, and we didn't even see half of it. It's a massive city. I had no idea it was the site. The excavation was so huge.
Yeah, really.
66 hectares or something.
Yeah. Interesting.
Some of that's the last 20 years, because when I visited it right in undergrad, it was not that big.
Yeah, and they've still got like 30% of it left to dig up.
That's crazy.
It's because it's full of Canadian engineers. I mean, that's a problem.
And that's what I found when I stumbled into the archaeological museum here in Naples, is they have a scale model of the town that they've dug up. So I spent a good 45 minutes standing over the model, tracing my route through the afternoon that we walked around, stomping around. It's a very impressive city. And these people were by no means barbarians, man. They had in-wall central heating. They had flush toilets from second stories. They had, rainwater cistern collections in the foyers of every house. It was very impressive.
What's the period of the city?
It went under ash in 79 AD.
Oh, you're talking about Pompeii.
Pompeii, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, goodness, yeah.
It is supposed to be very impressive. I've got a friend of mine who lives in Belfast, and he's been over a couple of times, and they were really impressed with the way it's been presented. He said it's actually a fascinating place.
Yeah, we lucked out because the people running our collaboration meetings set up a tour, so we had an actual tour guide take our group around. And he was really good, really lots of history, knew his stuff. He could answer all kinds of questions that we asked him. It was really fantastic.
So let me ask this question. This is something I'm fascinated about. When I studied, I took 4 years of Latin in high school. And when you finished your Latin, typically the second semester of fourth year, you got the vocabulary sheet for all the inappropriate words. And part of that was this famous book back then called Forbidden Pompeii, which was all the graffito.
Oh, yes.
Right.
And there is this perception that Pompeii had a pornographic quarter or a red light district. That's what I wanted.
Yeah. Yes.
But more recent scholarship has suggested, based on what I've read, that no, really the whole city was that way.
Large portions of it were, yeah.
So the whole city was a red light district?
Well, but no, the availability of sexuality, the availability of sex for hire, was pretty much ubiquitous.
That was part of what our tour guide was on about too. Because it didn't have the same mores as we do now.
No,
and it wasn't a big taboo for that.
No, because we look at it now from a moral standpoint of today, but in those days, it was obviously looked on in a completely different light, apart from being the red one, obviously.
Well, it was a profitable business.
Yeah. So it was not looked on as being anything particularly wrong. It was just the way things were. It's only us looking back now thinking, well, good heavens, isn't that terrible?
Well, right. And when we first discovered these things, again, my impression is we thought, oh, surely this is not all those nice people of Christian Pompeii.
Absolutely.
You know, and said, oh, that just must, we must have just dug up the section with the dirty people in it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That got to do with the people that were actually doing the digging as well, right?
Sure.
The main excavations were in the 1700s?
Yeah.
In fact, we were told that the first digging started about 14-something.
Actually, you saying that, Jim, about learning those sort of things in Latin. A lot of years ago, when I worked in a steel mill, and I was a metallurgical technician, we used to get a lot of students who came in to do work during their summer vacation. And we had a lad who worked with us from, well, at the time it was Iran, of course. He was still Persian in those days, of course. And one of the first things we did, we had a cultural exchange whereby we learned to swear in Persian and we taught him to swear in English. So,
first words that anybody learns in any language.
There's a couple of the words I can still remember, but I'll refrain from actually, unless somebody wants to email on them, and I'll pass them on. But it was quite interesting. But that was what we turned out as being a cultural issue, that we learned to swear in each other's languages.
Yeah, when I was, we were in Regensburg in August. To Vance's point about these people not being barbarians, I mean, the system of defenses that the Romans constructed, those, you know, the famous six castles that they built on the Danube, and the fact that this, first of all, I wish to speak out for my son, who everybody knows is Velker.
Yeah.
One of the things we found in Regensburg, you talk about finding things by accident, we discovered that when they were building their central car park, they discovered an ancient Roman wall beneath it, right, where they were digging. And of course, in Europe, as is properly the case, that immediately means you stop and figure out what you're going to do. You don't tear a first century wall down before you've had a chance to look at it and figure out, evaluate it.
Absolutely.
So what they did is they built the car park around it. And the wall is standing, and if you go down into the car park, there's a lovely interactive exhibit, including a huge video wall in multiple languages that talks about it and all this, and you can see the wall. Well, my son noticed that at the top of the wall, some goofball had tossed a cigarette. And this really bothered him. For four solid days, he was looking at me going, Dad, I can do it. I can reach that cigarette. I'm like, you are going to fall the 20 feet down. And I'm going to have to explain to the Regensburg authorities. Finally, he did wind up, and I have a picture of him. He swept it off. We bought an umbrella from the €1 shop. He swept it off. We picked it up, cleaned that. So there's that. But when you go to this museum in Regensburg, you realize how evolved was the Roman military system.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you talk about it, it really hits you. You say the word civilization, but in the first and second and into the third centuries AD, you had amazing constructions of, and they knew exactly what they were doing. That's the impressive part to me.
Absolutely, yeah.
You could see what they were essentially saying was, hey, you barbarian guys, such as we call you, you stay over there.
Well, that's right, yeah.
We'll trade with you, we'll do all this, but you are staying over there.
I mean, obviously, from my point of view, we're obviously very, very close to the Hadrian's Wall, and a lot of constructions all over the northeast. We've actually got fragments of wall within a quarter of a mile, half a mile away where we live. which were there to see. In fact, when Doug and Terry came over 4 years ago, we took them to a little village not far from where we live, and we passed quite a sizable chunk of wall. But then you go to places like Housesteads, which used to be a very large settlement on the wall, which is probably only no more than, I don't know, maybe 10 mile away. You can see actually how extensive it was. And there's fragments of the wall that you can walk along for quite a long length. It's a place called Steel Rig. And you can see what a commanding view over the valleys leading up to Scotland and onto the borders. And they were obviously the engineers who picked out the spaces where to build the forts and the mile castles. As you say, Jim, they really knew where their business. They knew what they were doing, you know. And some of the ruins are actually incredibly impressive and very, very extensive. There's a place called South Shields on the coast, which is where part of the wall was anchored. They've now got the museum, which was a very large base. It was a cavalry base. And being on the mouth of the river, River Tyne, it was a supply base because they obviously used to move a lot of material in by ship. And they've actually reconstructed one of the big gatehouses. And there's always people there, you know, wearing Roman gear and whatever. they really, you know, really do it properly. And it's extremely good. There's such a lot of Roman history. You almost take it for granted because you're living on the doorstep, you know. So, but it's some of it extremely impressive.
Yeah, I'm curious because while we were in Germany, there was, I mean, obviously I know about my Napoleonic reenactors. I've known about, what would you say now in Britain is the main reenactment thing? Is there any one that's bigger than the others?
Well, I would think probably the Sealed Knot, which is the English Civil War.
Really?
Which has got quite a really big following. And strangely enough, there's quite a few regiments of American Civil War reenactors as well. It's really popular. But then again, the Sealed Knot have actually got quite a few regiments in North America.
Yeah. No, I actually, through the Bristol Renaissance Fair here in Wisconsin, I know a bunch of Sealed Knot guys. So that's really interesting to hear that they're the deal over there. They're great guys. They really are.
They're very knowledgeable, most of them. They spend a lot of money on the gear. It's not a cheap hobby by any stretch of the imagination. But the Sealed Knot has actually got quite a large membership. And they are capable of, and they do put on a lot of very, very big reenactments. I mean, they don't go to the scale, and I've seen videos of the guys over in America who do American Civil War reenactments, and they're like huge. There's like thousands of people doing it, and it's very impressive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I would think, the English Civil War is probably the place where most reenactors go. There are other ones, just things like War of the Roses. That's got quite a following. People who, we know a guy who did it, does reenactments, and he's got plate armour. Again, stuff which has been made very realistically. And it's extremely expensive, you know. So it's not a cheap hobby by any means.
Why do you think the English Civil War is so popular?
I was going to ask the exact same question.
I think it's because it's a period which, so in a way, you can draw parallels with the American Civil War because there were social changes going on as well. There was this feeling that, you know, the monarchy was now at a point where it wasn't really governing the country. Things don't change very much, do they? where the government, you know, was lacking. So there was a lot of social changes going on. Having said that, I think there's probably less general knowledge about the Civil War period in the UK than there is perhaps you've got about your Civil War in North America.
I wouldn't count on that.
You know, if you've got it as a hobby, you tend to know a lot about it. But for most people in the street, if you ask them, they probably wouldn't even give you a date. You know, when it started, when it ended. So.
Yeah, unfortunately, I wouldn't count on that here in the U.S.
I mean, my PhD was in Tudor Stuart, England.
Right, yeah.
And which is, well, it's a long journey. Anyway, the guy that who's my principal professor, Dr. Dr. Johann Somerville at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I think he actually came from St. Andrews.
Right, okay, yeah.
And his whole thing was, he was an intellectual historian of the Civil War era. So I knew a great deal about it. I guess I'm a little bit surprised why, and I know, I agree with everything you say, that it is all those things. I'm pleasantly surprised that that's the case, that there's that awareness of those things. But I do wonder why that, and, you know, I'll put in my own two cents, why that and not Napoleonic.
I don't know. I think one thing that's very interesting at the moment is we have a lot of really good historians, people like Lucy Worsley, you probably get programs of over there, and we're seeing, especially people like the BBC, who are always very good at doing things like this, we've got a lot more programs now on the TV about history and about the history in the UK, which I think is starting to get people interested again. You know, a lot of people are thinking, oh, I didn't know that. That was interesting. I'll watch that again. The other thing is I could point out is where we live at the moment, we're just right by a place called New Bern. Mm-hmm. And New Bern is where in 1640 there's a ford over the River Tyne. It's where the Scottish Army actually crossed the river and laid siege to Newcastle. It's also got the distinction of having, it was where the first recognised battle of the English Civil War was fought. And that's probably, that's about, well, we can almost see from where we live, because we live quite high up on the Tyne Valley. We can almost see from where we live. It's, you know, such a mile away, if that. So there's a little bit of interest for you.
So my question is, what is the best preserved battlefield of the English Civil War?
I don't know if there are any. We don't look after our battlefields as well as you guys do. We have national parks, whatever. Culloden, which I know is not quite, obviously not Civil War. Culloden is a very popular place for people to go. And it's also one of the spookiest places we've ever been. It's got an amazing atmosphere there, as if when you're standing there, you look around, there's plinths that mark all the different positions of the battlefield. There's still one or two mass graves there, of course. You get the feeling that there's still something going on that you can't see. You know, you keep looking around and thinking, what's that? It's a very spooky place. And though it's set in, you know, a very countrified place, one thing we noticed is you didn't hear any birds sing at all over the battlefield. There's a lot of trees around there, and it's unnaturally quiet. And you actually get the feeling there's something still going on there, you know, that you can't see. It's very, very peculiar.
Yeah, Professor Pollard seems to, who did the gigantic Waterloo game at the anniversary last year, or this year, still this year. He regularly does pieces and tours at Culloden, so it does seem to be in good shape. I was curious, are any of them, you know, Marston Moor, Edgehill, are any of them in any kind of shape?
I mean, to be honest, I don't think I've actually, if I can remember, ever been to any of the Civil War battlefields. And again, one of the reasons being is because most of them are not preserved. You know, we haven't got as much space as you guys, so terrain and land tends to be more at a premium. So a lot of these places, unfortunately, haven't been as well. There's monuments there. There's plenty of monuments, but battlefields don't tend to get preserved as well as they perhaps could have been. And then it's too late, isn't it? Once they've gone and someone's built a supermarket on it, that's it, you've had it.
Well, and we certainly in this country have struggled with that. I mean, when I visited Fredericksburg, right, you come over the Rappahannock and you follow the charge of the Union troops up to Mayor's Heights, and you get to that famous wall at Mayor's Heights where the Union stood, and you turn around and you realize there's an apartment complex 150 feet behind you.
Right.
It's certainly imperfect. But in fact, as part of that same visit to Fredericksburg, there was a huge effort going on to buy out. I contributed to it, to buy out the slaughter pen from under Walmart, which wanted to build a mega Walmart right basically where the slaughter pen was.
Oh yeah.
And you know. So it's not, despite our space, because there is ample space out there, you're right. We sometimes, it is a marvel to me that when you go to Germany, you know, Leipzig is gone. The battlefield at Leipzig is mostly shot. And what, if you see the guys doing the reenactments, which always looks like 14 guys in a field, I'm afraid to say. You know, when you see the reenactment at Leipzig, all that's going on down by Libre-Volkowitz and the Mark Leisberg, where there's still some space. Leipzig is gone and Schleitz is gone and some of these others are out. But then you find some like Auerstedt and Jena and Egmull that are in incredible shape. You can unfold your operational studies group map, look at it, and it's right there.
Recognize it. Yeah.
You know, it's that gives you chills and is really cool. So it varies. I think a lot of it is just by accident. The Jena battlefield was preserved in large part because so many people did, including the Russians, even when they took over that part of Germany, they used it for artillery practice.
Oh, really?
Because they loved to come there, and they would say, and I talked to a lot of the locals, they would come there and play Napoleon at Jena.
Right.
So it gets preserved.
Well, Bob, you talk about how we've got a ton of space here in the U.S. The problem is where all those battles happened are near where there are fairly large and growing cities, mostly in the eastern U.S. There weren't a ton of battles that happened in upstate Colorado or in eastern Montana where we actually have space. So there's a lot of those, you know. Yorktown is sort of hemmed in.
Sharpsburg are being pretty well preserved, haven't they?
Yeah, and
sure. But that's because, well, in case of Gettysburg, we grabbed that almost immediately.
As a national
monument, if you will.
Sure. Yeah, I think Shiloh's the same as well, isn't it? Shiloh being preserved quite well.
Shiloh's in great shape.
Yeah.
Shiloh's in great shape. Yeah. And like I say, we do for Chancellorsville is a very good visit. Chancellorsville is chilling, and it also I've told this story more times than I care to count, but there's a thing at Chancellorsville. They mark the spot where Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee last parted.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they show you the spot, and then you get in your car, and you drive, and of course me, I'm obsessing, I'm pulling over every time I see a marker.
Yeah.
And I pull over. And you see this marker, and I've been driving at this point for probably, in a car, mind you, for 20 minutes, right? And I pull over, and the marker says, when Stonewall Jackson's troops arrived at this point, the last of his corps was leaving the spot where he departed from Lee.
Oh, wow. Incredible.
So and I went, that'll teach a lot about warfare just standing there.
Yeah, I imagine. I mean, although I've got no sympathies with either side in a way, I mean, the American Civil War has been a hobby and a passion of mine for, I don't know, 30-odd, nearly 40 years. And Stonewall Jackson, who I am as a man, is a bit of a hero figure for me because he was such a remarkable man. I mean, even now, the Valley Campaign stands out still. It's been a remarkable bit of generalship. You know, and you read about it and you think this man was absolutely a total genius, wasn't he? I mean, really, if you could say that Lee, once Jackson had gone, Lee was never really the same again, was he? You know, people say he was his right-hand man. I mean, the Valley Campaign, just incredible to read about.
One of my favorite conversations I ever had with a British person was where we were discussing the fact that we were discussing Antietam and the famous advance across the cornfield.
The cornfield by Hooker's First Corps.
That's it. And the thing that he couldn't understand was why a cornfield would have prevented that sort of line of sight.
Right, yeah, okay.
Anyway.
Yeah, I can understand where he's coming from because...
You know, and it was that confusion. And he said he read books about it for years, and he had this image of guys advancing in chest-high wheat.
Yeah.
There's a reason we carve mazes out of cornfields here.
Speaking of maize, It was that. So no, it is an interesting thing how, like you say, you've got the Civil War, American Civil War reenactors. We've got a bunch of English Civil War reenactors. I know these fellas fairly well. And we've got a lot locally of Napoleonic reenactors right down here in Illinois.
Yeah.
So it always does fascinate me how people will attach themselves. So how big is World War II reenacting? Because that's huge over here.
Oh yeah, there's quite a few people. I mean, there's one particular group who they're actually the Grossdeutschland reenactment group, and they've got some amazing amounts of equipment, and they do actually get used occasionally as extras in films. We were at a thing in the town moor in Newcastle a few years back where there was a lot of reenactments going on, and there was a group of guys turned out, and they were reenacting the 24th Panzer Division. Unfortunately, they haven't got any tanks, mind you, but never mind. So they were like the Grenadiers, Panzer Grenadiers, and the equipment they got was just absolutely spot on, you know, because like you do, you tend to be looking for flaws, and you're like, oh, that badge is wrong, or that they wouldn't have had that bit of equipment, or whatever. And these guys are just absolutely spot on. I think the biggest bit of equipment there was a Kettenkraft Krad, you know, a track motorcycle, and the Kubel wagons, you know, and stuff like that. But they were spot on.
No, we've got guys. We have one down here in Illinois that I go to every now and then, and I too am amazed by the stuff they've got. I'm always amazed by the guys that have Willie Jeeps. And I mean, they're pristine.
Hey guys, when we're talking about well-preserved battlefields, we don't want to leave Vance out in terms of Canadian victories where battlefields are well-preserved. Washington, D.C. is in perfect shape. So.
What did you say?
When we're talking about Canadian victories on battlefields that have been preserved over time, Washington, D.C. is in great shape.
It's in great shape, yeah. Well, yeah, but you laugh. We have the Plains of Abraham as well, where the English beat the crap out of the French, although for some reason the French are still here or there.
That's a long, complicated story.
It is a very long, complicated story. But yeah, they do reenactments up on that escarpment all the time, or like once a year.
I was going to ask about, in that context, the one that I always think of and the one that I really want to get to, just because it's the subject of the Stan Rogers song, why is my head blanking on me all of a sudden? It's the Heights. It is not the Plains of Abraham. It's the one from the War of 1812.
Yeah, it's a bit out of my period.
This is going to bug me.
As well it should.
Yeah.
Talk amongst yourselves. I have to find this.
To the Google.
Oh, that's it. The Battle of Queenston Heights.
Queenston Heights, yes. Yeah.
Because that is a place I've not been to and I need to get to. I've been to the Plains of Abraham, but I've been meaning to. Because, you know, that's 18...
Wolf. Oh, no, that Wolf was before that, wasn't he? Wolf was when we beat the French.
Yeah, that's what... Yeah. And that's what Vance is talking about. But as far as I'm concerned, it all counts as Napoleonic. Well, the Battle of Queenston Heights is 1812. That's Napoleonic. Yeah. Move on. Yeah. It is. Look at the uniforms you're wearing, and tell me you could stick a pin between that and a Napoleonic uniform.
That's true. That's very true.
What about the hats, though? Because hats are important.
They are wearing. And as a matter of fact, take a look at the Army of the U.S. that fought the regular Army that fought at, say, New Orleans. They're wearing Belgic Shakos.
Not sure that we agree with that. I mean, Jim's experts on hats, he'll tell us. It makes a big difference, you know.
Oh, no, I understand. And without proper outlandish hats, you're not having a decent battle, let's be honest. No, I've been catching no end of heck. Did you guys see this piece on this Russian Napoleonic expert who hacked his lover to pieces?
Yes.
Like everybody's, I've had to defend myself by saying I don't dress up as Napoleon, I dress up as Berthier.
As though that somehow makes it better?
Yes, it makes it less likely that I will be seen jumping into a river with my lover's arms in a bag.
Not necessarily.
Yeah, there's room for everybody in the hobby, Jim.
No, they keep showing pictures of him in his marshal's uniform. He wears his... I don't like his hat. His hat is not as good as mine either.
No, too showy.
It's just... No. Yeah, his. I don't like his feathering. I think it's wrong. I think his plumage is wrong. And I also think it's a bit too bent. You know, I wear mine front to back.
Yes, you got thwart trips is definitely frowned upon.
That's right. Well, and truthfully,
it makes it difficult to get in there to carriages, for one thing.
Well, but Jim, don't you wear yours front to back to better tack into the wind?
That's true. I don't want to be caught in irons. But no, the thing with the hat, Napoleon did wear his hats side to side. He wore them amidships because he wanted to be seen on the battlefield as distinct from his marshals.
Yes, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah.
If you look at all the famous paintings of his marshals around him, they're all wearing it front to back, and they're the much more outlandish. See, I'm just reading one article about this guy. Students described Sokolov as a talented lecturer who could impersonate the French emperor and his generals, but he was also a, quote, freak, unquote, who called his lover Josephine and liked to be addressed as sire.
Nice one.
See?
Wouldn't we all like to be addressed as sire?
On the other hand, when you look at it has to be said as well that most of his marshals were pretty tall, and he was a little fat, dumpy guy, wasn't he? So, you know, he wasn't quite as easy to spot as all the others.
Well, you compare it. Well, Mortier was the tallest of the marshals. He went 6'5".
Right.
So now Berthier, he also is short and stocky. Berthier, but yeah, I mean, Napoleon, though not as short as often depicted, would have been dwarfed by many of his marshals. There's no doubt. In fact, one of the reasons people have speculated he didn't wear an outlandish hat is when you do that, it does make you look shorter than you are.
Right. That's worth knowing.
If your body is disproportionate to the hat,
yes,
if your brim is too large, it shortens you.
What was that, Vance?
If your brim is too large, it shortens you.
Ah,
there you go.
I had a hatier tell me this when I was searching for a good fedora.
Okay,
this is something I realize has nothing to do with military history, but I do want to know. In Canada, and I'm going to ask the same thing about Newcastle. Is there still a good haberdasher?
Oh, yes, of course.
Absolutely. They're hard to find in Canada, but there are around.
Yeah. And we have people who do hats as well.
Stop it.
That's where I got my fedora, was that an actual
hat? Okay, so yeah, and I did too. My beloved fedora. I have an 8 1/8 head size.
Really?
Yeah.
I have a 7 3/4.
Yeah, so that's not small either. But
nope.
I went into a haberdasher who's no longer here in Milwaukee, much missed, and I said, "I bet you can't." And he said, "I bet I can." And he took my measurements and went, "Ooh, that could be a problem."
All right, everybody who's surprised that Jim has a big head, raise your hand.
I'm coming over there. I know where the Carolinas are roughly.
No, so actually, is the conclusion we're drawing from all this is that if you are grossly overweight and can't be bothered to diet, buy a big hat?
I think so. Well, first of all,
I'll put that on my to-do list.
Just get yourself a hat. I mean, I think you should have a hat no matter what you do. Every man should
have a hat. Yes.
And the more outlandish, the better. No, and if you've not heard this story, my hat comes from a guy who does a lot of hats in movies.
All right.
If he did all the hats for Master and Commander, I think.
Oh, cool.
And he did all the hats for the Horatio Hornblower series on A&E.
So do you prefer to be addressed as Master or Commander?
Right, no, Sire. Remember, go back. My wife got a hold of him and said, my husband really wants a Marshall's hat. And he said, it's just not. And then she showed him what it would look like. And he went, oh, my goodness. He went to Paris just because he wanted to have this in his arsenal. He went to Paris to see how they were made.
Amazing.
And if you look inside it, he actually recreated the label of the haberdasher in Paris he visited, who would have made hats for the Marshal. That same store still exists and would have made these hats for Napoleon's Martians.
Brilliant.
It is, as a consequence, the most expensive article of clothing I own.
Really?
It's not close. I own nice suits. They don't cost that much.
So in essence, your wife provided this guy with a tax write-off trip to Paris.
That's not wrong. He wanted to add it to his list because he said it's absurd. I want to have an absurd hat in my repertoire, and so he does.
Does Doug know about this? Because he'll be really upset, you know.
Oh yes. No. He is. He and I have had hat talk.
Yeah. He has a mighty fine hat of his own.
Oh, he does. He is a very excellent.
But on the other hand, of course, he has got a flag.
He does.
And he will flaunt that at you in response to any adverse remark about his headgear. He will immediately wave his flag at you and say, "Yes, but I've got this." And you haven't.
that's I when I went over to Leipzig, I bought a pair of magnets for him and I. I bought him the Blucher, and I bought the Napoleon, so they stare at each other from Poniatowski's gravesite. So there you go.
So, Vance, over there in Italy, there's not really a shortage of outlandish hats. Are you bringing one home with you?
Or even outlandish people to wear them.
Fair enough.
No, I am not. Not this trip. This is going to be a very long and involved project to get this experiment off the ground, so I'm going to be here very many more times.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, it saddens me that you are not leaving with the outrageous hat this time, but perhaps you can make amends at a future trip.
I'm pretty sure that I can.
Yeah. Are they hot on hat smuggling over there, then, are they, Vance?
Well, not the past year. It's been rainy and windy, so any good hat would have melted.
Oh God! Don't even say that. Think about my hat. My hat is many things, and I love all of them. One of them is not weatherproof.
Well, I bet you it's not your area winterproof either.
Oh no!
You're not getting a special waterproof cover for them, though, Jim. Surely.
Well, I am probably going to get an oilskin for it.
Yeah.
Although
you have
I don't have
to get a see-through bag for it, so we can all see it as resplendor even in the rain.
But that would be an anachronistic accessory, and therefore is verboten.
I thought it was only active duty military. To the best of my knowledge, First Empire is not considered active duty military.
They were certainly active. So in a very vague attempt to tie this back to a wargaming topic, what is the best depiction of an outrageous hat you've seen in a wargame, Jim?
Wow.
Wow.
What it was, man.
I mean, it's only taken us 50 minutes to get around to talking about a war game on a wargaming podcast.
Well, we discussed military things. Probably something out of the Total War series, because we forget that ancient warfare had many, many wonderful wild hats.
Oh, yeah.
Roman legionaries, Persian auxiliaries.
That's pretty true. Pickle hogs, even.
Well, you know what? Those actually might. You know what? I'm going to go with that. Those might be the silliest hats ever. Mm. I mean, I realize they're not, but they're not outlandish.
No, they're not. But they don't look very practical on the other end, do they?
No, I've never. As much as I've seen, I've never seen a credible explanation for why.
No.
For the pickle halba?
Spike on the top.
I thought it was to keep people from diving on you in the trenches.
Well, you're going back further than that. I mean, pickle hogs, you can get them back to sort of the Franco-Prussian War and the Seven-Week War. The Prussian army was still wearing pickle hogs, or at least the officers were. I don't think the rank and file were. So that probably comes a bit later. You're getting First World War-ish, aren't you? But I still think, who thought of, let's have this hat with a spike on the top? Because what's the likelihood of somebody jumping on top of me in the trench unexpectedly, and they're going to go, oh my God, I just landed on a spiky hat.
Yes, and what's it going to do to your neck?
Well, yeah.
I think the Italians are the Italian Wars in the before Napoleon, and they're foppish tam.
Those were outlandish. Oh, no.
Like an odd custom costume statement to do battle in.
I think we may have a winner here. Yeah. Well, first of all, I have to put in a shout for the Polish chapka worn by the Red Lancers.
Oh yes, absolutely. The one with the flat top.
Exactly.
Come on, then we get the winged hussar.
Did they not used to use them as mesh tables when they took them off?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, they did. I actually, when you go to Leipzig, they've got Poniatowski, because Marshal Poniatowski dies at Leipzig.
Actually, I think I could probably give you an even better contender if you look at that. If you look at the hats that the Janissaries wore from the Turkish Ottoman Empire, actually really pretty silly.
Those are good. Those are good. I'm actually looking at a. I actually Googled most absurd military hats, and along came. The Bogenschützen Leibgarde des Sultans, the Janissaries.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
They look like they have brushes extending out of their heads.
They're very, very strange, aren't they? I can think they must have got in the way, you know. I mean, how can you swing a sword when you've got one of those on top of your head?
Well, these guys are archers. These guys they're archers. Yeah. So that might work well. But these guys, these same Janissaries later on, it looks like they're holding matchlocks.
Yeah, could well be.
And they are wearing full-size brooms out of their heads. I would think these things would be top-heavy.
Yeah.
Vance, you mentioned the winged hussars. I don't know that the headgear necessarily was the key outlandish feature of that outfit.
No, but the wings, come on. That tops just about anything.
Well, I was at Polish Fest here in Milwaukee, and as we were walking, there was a guy late, clearly to some event or other, who came running up behind us in his winged hussar full uniform. And I'm like, okay, you are not getting away from me with that. Come here, I want to look at this thing. And it is an amazing, amazing piece. But no, I think I'm gonna go with Bob and say it's the Janissary hats.
Yeah, that gets my vote, definitely, yeah.
Those are, I mean, I love my bearskins, both British and French, which are pretty silly. Yep. Obviously, the pickle halva is going to be good. So if we're looking at a Mount Rushmore of absurd hats, which I think is how we best, because let's face it, these are all pretty absurd. I would say the bearskins generally.
Yes.
Because I've worn my share of bearskins, both French and British, and those suckers weigh.
Oh yeah!
I mean, we put one.
Bear in
we put one on my son when we visited London last, and he was wobbly. There's no doubt about it.
But he could ride any roller coaster on the planet at that point.
Right, because he's tall enough to ride that ride.
The thing that amused me about the French version of that is they've always seemed to have very large metal plates on the front and lots of dangly bits, you know. Various aigulettes and braid hanging off it, which must make it. I kept thinking, when it's wet, that thing must weigh a blooming ton, trying to carry that round on your head.
Yeah.
And then you think, you know, when you got the pioneers, who was the guys with the beards and leather aprons and a big axe and all that, I thought, they must be exhausted by the time they marched anyway with all that gear. And usually a big pack as well. Jim, you'll know this. You know the French pioneers, these guys again who always have to have a beard, don't they? And were they always chosen for their height as well? They have to be over a certain height.
Yeah, there's a minimum height, but there's also you don't get to be a pioneer if you're not recognized by your unit for bravery.
Oh right, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, you would have to be one of the great rituals of the Napoleonic army, and it may well have been of the other armies as well, but Napoleon turned it into an art. He would go in front of the unit that had been in a battle, and if he knew that they had embarrassed themselves, he would take their eagles from them.
Right.
And say, you don't get this back, for shame, for shame. And that unit would go crazy in the next battle to try to get itself killed.
Oh, right. It's just a psychological approach, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. But he would also go, and he would say, gentlemen, will you call out the names of someone who was brave and tell me what they did? and the expectation was you would shout out, oh, John Smith, he did this, and he would do everything from promote the person on the spot, grant his family a pension, and indeed then say, he would also say, you are now, you're a grenadier, you're a pioneer, you're raised to some higher rank, but you generally had to show yourself as having engaged in some notable act of bravery.
That's amazing. I mean, again, it makes you think as well of like Frederick the Great and his grenadiers, you know, had to be, what, 6'2" or something when they died?
6'2". 6'2", and then they put the hat on top of his head, yeah.
Yeah. So you think, well, actually, that's make a good target. You know, shoot the tall ones first.
Yes.
Yeah, that was so you could spot him in a cornfield.
Right. But no, I would say that in terms of depictions in war games, yeah, your top four, if you want to go find the silly hats, find something that involves the Janissaries, which covers an awful lot of ground, certainly all through the Renaissance.
Yeah.
Find something that involves the Grenadiers, which is a great opportunity to go pick out the new games in the Hollenspiel horse and musket line.
Oh, yes, indeed, yes.
Which will have, of course,
a matchlock about is now out as well, isn't it?
Yeah. For which, let there be full disclosure, for which Doug is now the lead developer on that system.
Well, I'm actually, I think, booked to play Horse and Musket on Vassal with Doug tonight, I think, later this evening.
Awesome.
And then he sort of, well, I think he's left it for me to choose the scenario, because it's my birthday tomorrow. Hooray. Yeah. So I may very well pick the first scenario in the original Horse and Musket series is Vienna, 1683. So that's got Janice in it.
It does.
Yes.
And
Polish Winged Hussars and stuff like that. So I may very well go for that.
Speaking of museums I've been thrown out of,
that sounds so nefarious.
The Austrian War Museum, same story. The World War II part was plenty interesting, but boy, oh boy, the period of the Turkish Wars.
Yes.
We took all their stuff. I saw the first one of these in Berlin, but they also had it in, they had a full-on Turkish campaign tent that they stole from the Sultan and have kept. And that's all in there. And yes, there are Janissary hats of the first order of magnitude. So that's a fine choice. Although it's interesting, too, from a study perspective, so much of where that was, where all those battles were, is now inside the walls of modern Vienna.
Oh, is it really?
Oh, yeah. For example, the famous East Gate that was
That's now
the Heldenplatz.
Right.
Where so many museums are, and most notably for my purposes, the equestrian statue of the Archduke Charles is.
Right.
You know, so that gate is preserved symbolically. They show where it was.
Oh yeah.
But it is well inside the city now. So
interesting. We've actually got not so much a friend as an acquaintance who lives in Vienna. She's actually, well, you know, my wife runs a World of Warcraft guild and has done for a lot of years. It's actually a lady who's one of her guild members. She's a retired opera singer and she lives in Vienna.
Well, that's not too incongruous.
Isn't it? That's good, that, isn't it? But apparently it's a very beautiful city from where I get that.
It's a lovely city. It's an expensive city. Oh, my goodness.
Reading something, whether this is true or not, not so long back, about the croissant, which we all like for our breakfast.
Yes.
Apparently, it was the creation of a French chef to, because it's obviously a crescent, to commemorate the defeat of the Turkish Ottoman army that was besieging Vienna in 1683. And he invented that as, record the event, apparently, and that's where the croissant comes from, because it's a crescent. How true that is, I don't know.
I will tell you that you will see that. And again, I've tried to verify that from a historical perspective, and I suspect that's I don't know if that's provable.
No. Pretty nice, isn't it? It's nice to think about when you're eating your croissant for breakfast.
But boy, oh boy, do they have croissants everywhere in Vienna. Boy, do you get told that story a lot.
Wait, you mean somebody embellished a historical tale?
Yes, somebody might be carrying on a legend. Well, what did this? What did the men who shot Liberty Vance tell us? Yeah. When the lie is better than the truth, print the lie.
Never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
And it is a heck of a good story.
Yeah.
Guys, we're a little over our 1 hour mark here, and again, I know that many of our podcast audience can just hit pause and come back to it later, but a couple of us do have some things to get onto for the day. If Vance wants to eat dinner before 10 o'clock local, he's going to need to get moving soon at the rate the Italians serve you in a restaurant.
They don't really start serving till 8 anyway.
So. Yeah. So, and Bob needs to go find an outlandish hat to be ready to wear for his vassal game of horse and musket later. So, guys, thank you very much for being here, especially having to span four time zones to pull this off. This was kind of outlandish in and of itself, but I think we managed well enough, even though Vance sounds like he's speaking through a cheesecloth the entire time.
Yeah. No, really? It's probably my connection.
It could well be.
Yeah. Well, we hope you're feeling better soon, Brent.
Yeah, me too. So, from across the Atlantic, Bob, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure, gentlemen.
And from across the Mediterranean, Vance, thank you for joining us.
We'll see you on the forums.
Yes.
Absolutely. We'll see you all there. And cheers to everyone. And remember, Saturday Night Fights every Saturday. Come fight things. Vance, we miss you.
Speaking of,
I'm coming back.
Jim, we got a request through the Facebook page of somebody wanting to know how to join a game, so I steered him your way in the forums.
Awesome.
So, thank you everybody for listening, and we will catch you probably only one, maybe two more episodes left in this season before we take a break for the holidays, and we will pick up the Madcap hilarity after the holidays again. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast archives as we're, 30-ish episodes at this point. And thank you for joining us. Goodbye, everybody. Sure.